Hi, welcome to Sacred Conversations with Vision Battlesword. This is an audio series created by me and by the Sacred Light spiritual community for our own benefit as well as for anyone else that might be interested to hear it. This represents a new kind of podcast or a new type of audio series that I call a community conversation. So I'll be talking with the Sacred Light spiritual community and we'll explore all types of topics from truth to philosophy, spirituality, consciousness, psychedelics, and many, many more. And the goal of this is just to explore reality, to explore truth, and to see what all of the different pieces and all the different perspectives are of reality that we can put together into an integration of an entirely new philosophy. So I hope you'll join me for this journey, and without further ado, here's our episode. Thanks.
Vic Chindal, we've been having a super, super stimulating conversation for the last hour or so, which has led us along many winding and crisscrossing paths, including topics from magic to belief to knowledge. What else have we talked about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's basically right.
Oh, we talked about presence, the meditative quality of riding a motorcycle, mm-hmm. and why that causes you to become present. We talked a little bit about how there can be magic and also wisdom and truth, deep truth, hidden in mundane things that we take for granted and don't notice, that we filter out of our perception. And I think that's really been the common theme of what we've been talking about for the last little while, is like the things that we filter
yeah.
in our perception,
the thread.
Yeah. That is the thread, isn't it?
Yeah, that is the thread.
Yeah, and how we, you know, what are we missing out on? What could we be seeing, experiencing, if not for the rigidity of our own filters or the limitations of our own filters that sort of inherently create, I guess, in a way, the reality, the internal reality that we experience. And so we looped back around to our previous conversation about open-mindedness and the analogy of the dark room.
Yeah.
Do you want to just kind of pick up there?
Yeah, just to like restate the analogy, I guess, first. And the analogy keeps changing, but I'll just go with the original for right now.
Yeah.
So it's this idea that our minds, for lack of a better term, our minds are a dark room that expands infinitely in all directions. And as we learn things, we're turning on light in the part of the room. So when we learn something and illuminate that thing, and over the course of our lives, we're walking around this room and illuminating different things that we're learning. And to some degree, we're just lighting up more and more of this room, but it's infinitely dark and expands all around us. And if we are closed-minded, this is the original analogy, if we're closed-minded, it's like putting walls in that room. And if we put up enough walls, it becomes a box. And we're lighting up more and more inside that box, and we sort of say, oh, I know everything, when in actuality, the whole outside of the box is completely dark. And so that's the limiting nature of closed-mindedness. Where we started to go with this, which I think is sort of the direction that you're talking about, is that the nature of those walls is actually like belief structures that we've created. And let's say reality is formless and limitless. It's like, let's say a data stream that's coming at us that we're in. The belief structures, these walls that we form around us, are filters by which we engage with reality, and we experience reality that is in line with the limitations that we've created. We filter out all the things that don't conform with the belief structure that we've created. And so that then suggests that we should be very mindful, I guess, about the filters that we're creating for ourselves and be more intentional about it.
With that as the preamble or as the context, who are you?
Oh,
Vic Chindal.
Yeah. I'm an individual that loves to understand things deeply, understand myself very deeply, so that I can live in a much more intentional way. And so the study of these things is something that I really enjoy in order to craft the life that I live with intention. I don't really know. I as I think about that question more and more, I realize that it's almost impossible for me to answer in some sense. Like, who are any of us really? I mean, we're constantly evolving. We have belief structures that are constantly evolving. We have value systems that are constantly evolving. So we're really just like receivers of this data stream that we're then just manipulating around us and in the context of this conversation. So yeah, I'm increasingly, for lack of a better term, open-minded about who I am.
Does that mean you're losing your identity, or does it mean your identity is dissolving, or does it mean it's moving into a more evolutionary, like, is your identity now more of a process and less of like an artifact?
Yeah, that's such a great way to question. That's a great next question. So I think the reason I'm having a hard time answering the question is because I'm realizing how much of my own inadvertent belief structures have formed the basis for who I think I am. And so as I remove belief structures that don't really serve me in some way, or that I don't want to have anymore, or that I'm inadvertently creating, the things I thought I knew about me are changing. And so if you were to take that at its limit, in some sense, if you were to remove all your belief structures, like, how would you define yourself at all, right? And so as I go through the process of removing, fine-tuning, evaluating the belief structures that belong there, that I'd like to have there, and even whether belief structures serve me at all, which will be part of this conversation, to narrowly define myself, to narrowly define anyone, becomes more problematic, I think.
Ah, this is such a perfect setup and such a perfect, what's the word, callback or loop back to, I think, everything that we're talking about. Because it sounds like what you're saying is to define myself is inherently to limit myself in a way.
Yeah.
Or like to define an identity is to narrow the scope of possibility for that identity.
Yeah. And, you know, in our prior conversation, I had said that like to be fully open-minded was to bring down all these walls. Like the walls that we created are forms of closed-mindedness, and that the goal would be to bring down all of the walls, and that's to be like truly open-minded. And in some sense, that is absolutely true.
In some sense, that is the goal is true?
Yes, yeah, sorry. In some sense, the ideal is to bring down the walls. I can see that perspective. I'm saying like that could be one perspective that has some validity to it.
Okay, that's fair. I'm not necessarily agreeing with it.
Yeah. But actually, as I have gone down this process of evaluating it more, I think actually the more intentionally designing a structure around you that allows you to engage in the world in the way that feels more alive to you is better. Because if you were to completely dissolve all these walls, that maybe like you would live in a mountain somewhere, you know, as a monk, you know, kind of meditating all day, and who knows, you know, I don't know if that would remove so much structure that you couldn't actually function in society. And so to the extent you want to function in society, I do, you do, etc., I think belief structures can be helpful. The question is, can we create these belief structures with more intention rather than the inadvertent ways that we do them now? And I believe that it's true, but that implies that if these structures are much more malleable than we thought before, defining yourself is almost is limiting in the sense that for this moment in time, you want to have this set of belief structures. And for another moment in time, you might have another set of belief structures that more fit what you're trying to accomplish at that point in your life. And so in some sense, your identity is like as you define it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we asked ourselves earlier the kind of thought experiment question, what would it actually be like?
Yeah.
What if we could imagine, can we imagine what would that state be like of when all the walls are down?
Yeah.
Of when there's no belief system, when there's no belief structures, if, again, taking it as a perspective to entertain, if that is the ideal, or rather, if that is the maximum potential, the maximum possibility for experience, if it's true that all belief structures or systems inherently create filters or limitations to experience, direct experience of reality, then what would it be like if they were all those filters were removed? Would it just be going back to the moment of conception? Would it be like going to a singularity? Would it be like a completely formless, non-dual state? What would it be? But in any case, if you kind of imagine it going in that direction, it does seem to indicate a state of non-functionality from a perspective of this 3D material world that we cruise around and bump around and do our things in, potentially.
Yeah, I think we're skipping a step maybe in this conversation of like more describing or discussing how this belief structure actually impacts on reality. Right. So like,
I think so too, but there's a couple more pieces that I want to put on the table just as far as the setup of things that we've already covered.
Yeah.
Real quick to like, just kind of get all the Tinker toys out on the table and then let's start moving them around and see where they go. So that was one piece, was like, okay, what if there was no belief system? What would that be like?
Right.
And then there was another really important piece, was because we were talking about magic.
Yeah.
And what you were bringing up, which I thought was a really interesting line of thinking to pursue, is there's the piece about magic, but then there's also the piece about trust in knowledge, or trust in sources of knowledge, how do we know the things that we know?
Yeah.
Where did this knowledge come from? How did it come to me? Why do I trust the source of it?
And then how does that impact our belief structures?
Exactly.
Right. Right.
When I think the point you made, which I think is very valid, and I think it's also like kind of can lead to an existential crisis if you follow the line of thought too far.
And I think a lot of people are there, actually.
They might be.
Yeah.
But when you start actually asking yourself the question, which I have done, I've been doing it for a long time, and it can be very disconcerting.
Yeah.
You ask yourself the question, how do I really know what I know?
Yeah.
Why do I really believe? I mean, a classic example, moon landing, flat earth, different things, right?
Totally.
You start asking yourself the question, well, how do I actually know this to be true? I think if you start to consider how much you know from your own direct experience, or even your own direct reasoning of having worked it out for yourself,
right,
it's not a whole lot.
Yeah. So, right. So that there's two sources of knowledge.
Yes.
Right. There's the source of knowledge that you get from direct experience.
Correct.
Right. And then there's the source of knowledge that you get from trusted sources, right?
Correct.
Like you're reading something, or you get from a teacher, or you talk to people, and there's knowledge that comes. And if you really think about it, the percentage of the knowledge that you have that actually comes from, quote, trusted sources
is vast,
is huge, is a huge proportion of the knowledge that you have rather than direct experience.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we were talking about how like all these things like the telepathy tapes are coming into our awareness, and all kinds of different things that we wouldn't have entertained probably, you know, 30 years ago quite as easily.
Maybe people like you and me wouldn't have.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Right.
And and even I'm quite skeptical.
Totally. Right. And so we're just different things that we're observing that I think people are more able to hold these ideas that they didn't previously hold. And I think part of the reason that that is happening is because the knowledge that we hold, let's say from our own experience, direct experience, and from third-party sources, helps form our belief structure,
right?
And it forms like these walls, this box around us by which reality is filtered and that we experience. But in our society, what we're experiencing is a wholesale questioning of what we call trusted sources.
Yes.
Like everybody is feeling that no matter where you are on any political spectrum, we're all kind of feeling, do I trust this person? Do I trust that person? Do I trust this? Do I trust that? Whatever. So suddenly, if you think about the panoply of knowledge that you have in your head that you thought you knew,
right,
suddenly there's a whole host of those things that feel a lot more squishy.
Yeah.
That you're starting to question, is the thing that I know, the true, because now I'm questioning the source, the underlying foundation on which that knowledge was based. And right. So suddenly, and if that knowledge that you have formulated the belief structure that you have, and you're starting to question the knowledge, suddenly the belief structure that you have becomes a lot squishier, a lot more malleable. Suddenly, like, the rigid walls are not as rigid.
Or some walls can even come crashing down.
Some, like, suddenly come crashing down, right? And so, and if you think about these belief structures as forming your identity, and you're, like, very deep in the process, not realizing how much those formulate your identity, and then they start, you know, being squishy or come crashing down. One, there's a crisis of identity that occurs, I think, for a lot of people in that. I think you're starting to see people, like, being in a state of, I guess, spiritual crisis that is, like, engulfing more and more people.
I think the word crisis is correct. Yeah. And then I think you can put a bunch of different words in front of it.
Totally.
It can be an identity crisis.
Totally.
Spiritual crisis.
Totally.
Existential, even like a reality crisis.
Yes, totally.
And I think that's really what's starting to unravel for a lot of people, myself included in a certain respect, is like, how do we know anymore what is real?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are asking themselves that question in this age of
AI and all this
digital, like, yeah, digital everything. And look, if I only know something because I saw it through a screen,
yeah,
do I really know anything?
Totally.
Not sure anymore.
Totally.
Or even what I've been told. Totally. You know, there's a lot of, like, new history coming to light, and there's a lot of, you know, alternative facts. And
yeah.
Yeah, I think that we may be going through what there's a name for it, the Cartesian crisis, because it essentially goes back to, you know, Descartes, the base Cartesian philosophy or fundamentals as a baseline of epistemology, you know, reasoning from that starting point of, okay, I have the capability to think, and now from this point, I have to work it out for myself from there. You know, what, like, how do I build my way up to a working model of reality from, all right, I am a subjective identity that has thoughts. And I think a lot of people are bootstrapping back to that point, going like, okay, I don't know what I can believe anymore. I'm going to have to, like, start over and work from my lived experience back up to something that feels stable.
Right. So again, if our belief structures are a filter for reality, where reality has a lot of possibility, but our belief structures restrict our experience in some way as a filter, where reality conforms to our belief structure. And then those belief structures start to change, not with intention. They're just changing without just really understanding that they're even changeable to begin with. That can create anxiety and crisis, I think.
But it can also create potential and opportunity. Well, is that where you're going?
Yes, that's where I'm going. So it can feel like that in the near term, but it ultimately serves us, because it's just a matter of just getting a handle on it, on the fact that this is happening. And so these belief structures are actually completely malleable. And in plant medicine and different experiences that people have are ways of making belief structures more malleable. They help us do that through neuroplasticity, et cetera, that they help us experience. And so these belief structures, these filters for reality, become more malleable. And so as these things are becoming malleable or disintegrating, people are now experiencing different aspects of reality they didn't think possible for.
Which we might call paranormal phenomena, magic.
Yeah.
Altered states of awareness.
Totally.
All this kind of stuff, which I think ties it back to what you were saying earlier, which is, if we go through the world with a belief system that says magic is definitely not real,
yeah,
that says telepathy is a hoax, that says, you know, supernatural is a superstition, is primitive thinking. If we go through life with a belief system that says the only things that are true and real are those things which can be detected by instrumentation of a materialistic worldview, we may not actually have the frame of reference to experience things which are actually happening.
Exactly. Let's do a more concrete example before we go to this, like, because the magic thing, it's a little bit harder to grasp, but let's go to a narrow one, the Elon Musk example.
Sure.
Okay. So he does things in his work life that are utterly amazing, right? Like he's building this car company, he's building spaceship companies, he's doing all kinds of things that I think most of us, certainly me, would have deemed like this is impossible. Like one of the things that always was said is you cannot create a new car company in this country. It's just, they're too massive. You would never be able to compete. They would crush you. You could never create a space company that's private that would compete with all the governments of the world, you know, and then he's doing stuff with those rockets that none of those nations have ever done. And I think it's because the nature of his filter, my filter says that those things are impossible. His filter didn't have that governor. Mm-hmm. It didn't have that limitation. Mm-hmm. His filter of his reality did not say that those things were impossible. So in his reality, he was able to create those things because his filter said that they're entirely possible. And so the difference, if in my reality, those are impossible, I will never achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
In his reality, if they are possible and he's interested, et cetera, in doing those things, it is possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the reality that he experiences.
Here's another great example that we talked about a few moments ago or before we started the recording, your experience when you lived in New York City.
Mm.
You know, just this is a very concrete, I think very relatable example. Like everyone's had this kind of experience where the power of your own mind to literally filter out sense data, to filter out sense perception. So you're living in New York and I had this experience, you know, on the other end of the phone, you're describing having a conference call or a phone call with someone where they're noticing how much noise pollution there is in your environment, and they can hear it quite clearly on the other side of the phone, and it's driving them, you know, a little frustrated or something. And you were immersed in that environment for so long that your brain learned how to actually literally create a filter so that you weren't even aware, you weren't even having the experience of, you know, sirens and traffic and whatever are the normal noises of a big city downtown. Like we know that we're doing this.
Yeah.
We know that our expectations create our experience.
I think, and so this is what's interesting is that like we think of it as purely a neurological filter. You know, in some sense where it's like, I'm just filtering out the noise and you're not because you're not used, like you don't live in New York City. I lived in New York City. If you were calling me, I wouldn't hear it. I hear all the traffic and the sirens, but you do because you're not having that same filter. And we think of it as just purely kind of a localized thing. But really, I think that it is actually filtering at a much greater level reality.
Yeah. I mean, when you're talking, what I'm thinking over here is you put a label on something. This is such a scientific materialist kind of like thing to do.
Yeah.
You put a label on something. Yeah. Oh, well, it's a neurological filter. Obviously.
Yeah.
That doesn't explain anything.
Yeah. Totally.
Nope. And it doesn't make it any less mysterious.
Yeah. That's
or even magical.
That's a great point.
You know, like relate it back to my thought experiment that I shared, you know, in that.
Like we have a habit of even limiting the evaluation of the experience by the label, like
exactly.
You're talking about, right?
But when you actually think about it, what is a neurologic filter?
Yeah, totally.
How does that work?
Totally.
What does that even mean?
Totally.
Like there's literal sense data that is loud enough to wake me up from sleep. That is loud enough to, and I literally don't hear it.
Yeah.
Like my brain can do that.
Yeah.
And that brings me back to that thought experiment that I shared a little while ago, which is like, what if you could put on, let's just say physical glasses in this case. You put on some physical goggles that in some way filters out certain spectrums of light or certain types of visual input, filters them out so that certain objects in your environment become literally invisible.
Mm.
You can't see them while you're wearing these goggles because they're that specific shade of gray. The chair just disappears. It's that specific, whatever it is. Can't see it.
Yeah.
But yet I know it's physically there, or at very least, like I can still sense it tactilely. I can bump into it. I can touch it. That would be a really confusing, disorienting experience. And what I'm proposing is that we know our brains are doing that. Because if you live in New York City for more than a month, you stop during the traffic. There's so many other examples of this. So in just taking that and expanding it to like, wow, wait a second.
Yeah.
What else is it possible that I'm missing?
Yeah.
How powerful actually is my brain to create these neurological filters that creates what I call reality?
Yeah.
And how could that, how different could that be if my belief system was different?
Right. And so taking this further to its limit, if reality, let's say we have been so conditioned to filter out so much of what reality truly offers through these constructs that we've created, what happens when you start to remove those governors?
Mm-hmm.
Right? What is it that we experience?
Mm-hmm. Or if they just start to get a little mushy.
They get a little mushy. Mm-hmm. We start to like have experiences that are much more vast than we previously thought possible,
mm-hmm.
which we might experience as magic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we think of magic as supernatural. I was talking to a friend about this. We think of magic as a supernatural thing. He was saying, I don't believe in the supernatural.
What does that even mean,
supernatural? Well, so my point is actually, I'm coming increasingly to the clear conclusion that magic is actually perfectly natural. It's just how reality works. We just conceive of it. We put a label on it and we think of it as outside the boundaries of what is possible, when in actuality, that is not true at all.
Right.
It's just the filter that we've created such that we don't see it.
Right. Yeah. Just coming back to the Elon Musk example. And as I mentioned also, it's so unbelievable to me that anyone ever still says something with such arrogance or such certainty as that is impossible.
Totally.
Because how many times have people like that been proven wrong? I mean, totally. To the airplane, like, we'll never be able to create a heavier than air, machine. Like, it just over and over and over and over again. And it's only impossible until it's not.
Totally.
It's only impossible until someone decides to make it possible.
Totally.
And that point, the word decide, is the key. That's the crux of the whole thing.
It's like choice.
So again, to your point about magic or the supernatural phenomenon or whatever you want to call it, it's like, as long as we believe that reality is inherently limited to this particular scope of experience, it seems very likely that that's what our brains will trick us or convince us that's what's happening.
Yeah,
it'll condition us that they expect.
Yeah,
that's what it expects.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's all kinds of experiments about this, about like how our brains actually are filling in so much of the detail. I can't recall any of the experiments right now, but you know what I'm talking about, right? Whereas actually, like, our brains, they're obviously taking in a lot of data, but like, there's a lot they're just filling in.
Yeah, we're watching and listening to a high resolution 3D hologram created internally through our virtual reality modeling system,
right?
Based on like 8-bit pixelated.
Totally. And we're just filling in we're just filling in the details,
right? Not just filling in, but we're like embellishing.
It's making it completely different. Right. And so and the question is like, what is the limit on that? And I would argue that the limit is like much, 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 much greater, if any, than we have even been able to conceive. And so then we go back to your question about like, okay, so these belief structures are more malleable. And so can we take these belief structures? We certainly want to take down the belief structures that make us feel awful, right? Like all the time, I think. What we would consider limiting beliefs, like in a traditional sense, like limit our potential, like we were talking about. But all belief structures under this rubric are inherently limiting because they're all filters. So then the question is, though, does that mean take down all beliefs? To your point, which is like taking down all the walls such that you see all of what reality has to give without any filters. And I think that might serve one in very limited instances for spiritual understanding, But I actually think that we need belief structure in place in order to be in this like 3D reality. Otherwise, if reality itself is effectively just a massive data stream that's formless, your belief structure creates the form in which you experience reality.
Right. That's where I think we're headed. Yeah.
And so then if you can remove the things that you don't want and then more intentionally form these belief structures, that could be a really amazing life, I guess, you know?
Yeah. Well, I love where this is headed, and we got there very quickly, but I think there's a lot more to explore too, which is that particular reframe that you just stated. It seems to me shifts things away from a bit of a moralistic overlay when we talk about limiting beliefs, or when we talk about the goal of open-mindedness or the ideal of open-mindedness or things like that, where it becomes less about more limitation is bad and less limitation is good. And it shifts from that to what kind of reality would I like to experience?
Yeah.
And how would I like to create that?
Yeah.
It becomes more of a choice, and it becomes more of a, well, intentional evolution,
yeah,
you know, in a way. Meaning, yeah, maybe I don't actually want to knock down all of the walls.
Yeah.
Like another analogy is like a house, you know, or an apartment. It's like one could say, gosh, you know, all the walls in this place are really limiting my freedom of movement, because I can't just go directly from here to there. I've got to go around this corner and down this hall,
yeah,
and then open this door and such. But it's all contextual.
Yeah. I mean, if you had no walls, you'd have no house at all.
You'd have no house at all.
Yeah.
You'd have no shelter.
Totally.
If there were no interior walls, maybe you'd have no privacy,
yeah, totally,
et cetera. So it's like, why are these walls here is the question.
Yeah.
How? What are they doing for me?
Yeah.
Or are they not doing anything for me? Is there maybe actually like, I'm imagining sitting in your apartment right now and you've got a beautiful apartment with an open floor plan. We're in your living room, which is completely open and connected to your kitchen. And now if I imagine like a big wall dividing your living room from your kitchen with just a little window in it and maybe a small door, then I could imagine like, that feels kind of limiting.
Yeah, totally.
I would like to be able to see the kitchen if I'm entertaining, you know, guests. I'm going to take that wall out.
Right.
I have a reason for that though. I'm trying to expand my space.
But you wouldn't
take out my mind.
But you wouldn't take out the wall between my apartment and the hallway.
Or maybe not even the one between your kitchen and your bathroom.
Right.
For reason. Right. It's like there are reasons that this structure exists.
Yeah.
You know? But I think the key insight here is asking yourself that question.
Yeah. And
evaluating your floor plan from.
Yeah. And I think even as we're talking about this, you know, as you're talking about reevaluating your floor plan, it's like we have constructed our society in such a way based on these very rigid beliefs that could be conceived, like we could consider those narrow in some ways.
Correct.
And so the thing that's happening in society around the dissolution of knowledge of what we thought was things we knew that then makes these walls more fuzzy. It feels rough. It feels like we're going into some kind of weird, dark thing. But I think that this is sort of the awakening actually that people are talking about that also is an underlying current that is happening. And so, yes, there's this underlying anxiety that's felt by a lot of people as the belief structures erode, which is related to the ego dissolution that they're probably feeling and dissolution of identity. That then maybe creates a clampdown on what they thought they knew. I don't want to hear this. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see this. And so there's that push-pull. But ultimately, the recognition that these belief structures are more malleable will long-term serve us and could radically redefine how we interact with society.
Mm-hmm.
And so that could be really interesting, actually. Yeah.
Not just society, but all of reality.
Yeah, totally. But I'm saying like us as a society, like we'll go in baby steps here.
Yeah.
Right? And so like, I think that we are on the cusp of something really beautiful.
For sure.
but it will be a rough entry.
As it always is.
Yeah, when we're,
well, yeah, well, I did an episode of this series called Breakthrough with a friend of mine named Michael Barr. And we explored a lot about what happens at the transition, the boundary between one phase or stage of whatever, life experience, belief, et cetera, and the next. And there's a reason why we call it a breakthrough, right? And not just a like tiptoe over or a path through.
Yeah.
Because I think, it's inherently disruptive. It can feel like a death. It can feel like a death and a rebirth.
Yeah.
If you take the transformation analogy, you know, caterpillar to butterfly and so forth, like on the way from being a fully functional caterpillar to being a completely different kind of creature almost altogether.
Yeah.
There's a total disillusion of self that happens through that process.
Yeah.
I think we're doing that individually. I think we're also doing that collectively.
Yeah.
And my opinion is that we're doing it not just collectively as a society or civilization. We're also actually currently in that process at the species level right now.
Yeah.
I think we're in a very, very unique, special moment in the cycle of history.
But, I mean, by the way, I mean, you could, I mean, if we were really to take this in some really weird directions, I mean, you could also argue that it's happening at multiple species levels, like, because like we have this idea that this is a belief that we have, for example, that we are the only ones that evolve.
True.
And actually, I read this article recently where they were saying that dogs are, through their domestication, are becoming like more aware of their surroundings and more able to interact with humans in a more nuanced way than we had thought possible or reasonable, because they're like evolving as well
through
the domestication, which makes total sense. And maybe we weren't able to see a lot of that stuff because of our, again, former belief structures that are now becoming more malleable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just everything that we thought we knew. I mean, think about that. Like, so much of what we thought we knew, we don't really know anymore. And so some of that stuff will maybe be a little bit unhealthy, like in the sense of like, it or come across as a little unhealthy or a little bit like, you know, it'll go in like weird directions, let's say. Because at first, as this dissolution happens, probably there's not, a lot of people aren't going to be trained on the discernment aspect of it. And so you're like, okay, did we land on the moon? Did we not land on the moon? Did we do this? Did we do that? Like, who knows, right? And so like suddenly, is the earth flat? Is it round? Like, people are going to question stuff, and some of it's going in like weird directions that doesn't feel like all that productive, frankly, to me at least, but whatever, not judging. And
but I think it just goes to show you, not to interrupt your thought process, but just to put a pin in that one point, I think that level of questioning demonstrates how deep the Cartesian crisis is really going.
Totally.
And as a phenomenon, I find it interesting and, I don't know, possibly helpful, but at least indicative of like the potential to recreate our collective belief system goes pretty deep.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally, right?
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, totally. And I mean, if you think about this, like, we haven't really touched on this, but like, that's sort of happening with like alien kind of thought process that's happening out there, and UFOs, like, where a lot of people are starting to believe more in that. And you could argue that as our belief structure around that changes, we are actually experiencing that phenomenon more.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a guy named Thomas Campbell. Mm. I think his name is Thomas Campbell. He's a very interesting person. I want to read some of his books, but I was listening to him on an interview, and he's a theoretical physicist who's like deep into astral projection and all kinds of stuff. So he has a particular ability to bridge the physics and some of these spiritual concepts in a way that other people can't.
You know, it's not that uncommon. Right. I mean, like, just for people who we associate with some of the most important scientific breakthroughs or feats of technological engineering and so forth to have been deeply religious or spiritual or even superstitious.
I think the people that are on the frontier are like that. Like, Einstein was like that.
Isaac Newton comes to mind. Totally. Nikola Tesla.
Totally. Like, people who are on the, like, really, like, because their minds are more open to what is possible. It's like their filters are less limiting. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I agree with you. Right. So anyways, he's one of those types. He has this notion that I really love, that he's like, when you look out at a telescope, okay, when you, let's say you have a telescope, you point it in a random direction of the sky, that you, there is nothing that exists there until you look out the telescope. And then it's basically, there's a probability of what could be there based on your belief structure. So there's a small probability that it'll be a pink elephant. And there's a much, much higher probability that it'll be a star, mm-hmm. or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's some kind of random probability distribution that occurs. And then boom, you see whatever it is that you see.
Hmm.
And that is happening all the time. And then as our collective belief structure is changing, that would imply that the belief, that the probabilities are changing of what we should see. And that might be increasing the reason that we're looking up and starting to see things in the sky that we didn't previously see before. Mm-hmm. And so that would be another way of thinking about this reality filter,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, well, that's really interesting, because there's there's many different ways, but there's a couple of different ways that occur to me right now of how you could, like, what hypothesis you could suggest for that phenomenon. The phenomenon meaning that the more people start to believe in aliens, the more we all collectively may start to experience aliens.
Yeah.
Just to make it simple.
Yeah.
One of which is, as we create a collective belief system, we may begin to manifest
totally
what we expect,
yeah.
to be real.
Yeah. That reality is actually completely formless. And it's formed by, like, the version of reality that we're experiencing is just completely created in the construct of our belief structure.
Right, right. Yeah. And again, even within the manifestation branch, there's another fork that you can go down, which is when we say manifest the experience of seeing, interacting with, having the experience of aliens, could be completely psychological,
right.
meaning we manifest it in our minds,
yeah,
or it could be actually tangible, meaning we manifest it into reality, into yeah. the material world. Then on the other side of the fork is the kind of removal of filters hypothesis, which is the more that we collectively start to believe in the existence of aliens and that we're being visited frequently, we actually begin to be able to see them.
Yeah.
Whereas before we couldn't see them because yeah. of the goggles that we were wearing.
I would argue that they're actually the same. What okay. you're describing is the same. That reality is actually formless, except the reality that we're filtering in, and then we're experiencing a version of reality that's defined by our filters.
Mm-hmm.
And if we remove those, like change those filters, our reality is changing. And so, like, suddenly we are seeing things that wouldn't have existed at all had we not changed that filter.
Yeah, right. And then there's a kind of a multiverse variant of that.
Totally. You know, right, exactly.
Suggestion that you...
Right, because, like, based on the belief structure that we have. So there's a version of reality where our belief structure is completely static and didn't change, and we don't see
right.
aliens at all.
And there's one more variant, which I think I would be irresponsible not to at least point out, because, you know, maybe anyone else could think of it, which is the actual magic trick fork
uh-huh.
of possibility, which brings us back to the original conversation we were having around illusionists and mentalists
yeah.
and stage magicians and stuff, which is, it could also be that we begin to collectively believe in aliens because we're being subjected to trickery.
Totally.
We're being subjected to illusion.
Totally.
Psychological operation, whatever you may call it.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
And then that then leads to the question of, can you induce new belief structures
now it's getting
based on trickery?
Yeah, right.
Right?
So if we trick enough people into believing in aliens, can we actually manifest them
yes.
into reality?
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know.
Okay, well, here's the burning question that I've been on the tip of my seat waiting to ask when there was the right moment. And I feel we've finally arrived at the point where all the Lego blocks and Tinker Toys are spread out on the play floor here. And so my question for you is, okay, we've used this word about 1,000 times so far, but what is belief?
It is the way you define reality.
I like that.
Yeah. That's the way you define reality.
Belief is a way of defining reality.
Yeah. And so it's completely, I'm actually just having a realization that this actually is completely related to your ego, not in a bad sense. Like, we all have a way that we relate to ego that is personal to us. And it's the way we relate to reality, the way we experience reality, et cetera. And so these beliefs form the entire way we experience reality.
Yeah. There's something about belief that has to do with predicting reality, I think also. It's definitely a statement about reality.
Yeah. Just to explain what you mean by that.
Well, you know, when I think of, a belief structure like the dark is not safe, for example, or things always fall down. I'm just thinking of like beliefs, the way we normally frame belief statements.
Yeah.
Sometimes they seem to be a concrete description of facts that we think are true.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes they also seem to be predictions of what we think will happen in circumstances.
I think that they're both true. Mm-hmm. And so it goes back to that probability matrix kind of Thomas Campbell point of view, I guess, to some degree, is that the dark is not safe, let's say, is the belief structure. Will you always experience bad things in the dark? No, probably not, unless you're exceptionally unlucky, I'm guessing. But the probability that the dark is an unsafe place for you to be increases, because your reality, your belief structure is increasing that probability.
Mm-hmm.
And so i.e. the probability that something bad will happen in the dark is actually increasing. The probability that you'll experience a version of reality that is like that increases based on your belief structure.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this is something to be really keyed into, is this idea that we create, this is getting very metaphysical, but I really think about things like this. Let's say, and I think this is a lot of what people suffer from. I know I have personally experienced this. I think we're in reality creation, but completely unaware that we're doing it. And that's the illusion that people talk about. And so let's say you have trauma that makes you feel unworthy or whatever, right? And then, or you just have a belief structure that you're going to fail at whatever. And then you fail. The experience then creates a worse feeling, more stories, more belief structures and it reinforces that thing that then actually causes you to circle the drain in your life, where bad things will happen, then bad things do happen that cause you to reinforce that view, maybe even become more negative. And that's where you have if you have these beliefs that you're forming, unaware that you're forming them, you're just automatically doing it. You experience that reality. You then have another bad experience. You're just kind of forming a reality that you're just living in that keeps getting worse and worse and worse.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I think a lot of people live.
Mm-hmm.
And so can we step out of that? Can we get out of that mode of thinking? Yes, I believe we can. It's just sort of stopping the automatic story creation that we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm following everything you're saying there. I think I might have stumbled on something kind of interesting with this idea of beliefs as a statement of predicting the future, or predicting what the expectation of reality is.
Yeah.
A lot of times they're they're forward-looking statements.
Yeah, that by their
story. You just said one. I just want to call attention to what you just said. I believe that people can change their belief system or something along those lines. So it's, again, it's if you really deconstruct the syntax you are making a statement about what you think will happen.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, you're making a statement about how you think things are. And I'm just sitting here like breaking down, like, what is the utility of this phenomenon?
So think about that. Let's think about that for a second. So it is, I think there was this idea, like Buddhists have this idea. There's a lot of different cultures that have this idea that reality is actually formless.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is like a house with no walls. It's like so formless that unless you have the belief structure, there's nothing to latch onto. There's nothing mm-hmm. to construct around.
Right.
You know? And so I believe so fervently, I feel like I know that these belief structures can be modified.
I think the word structure is like critical mm-hmm. here. Meaning like that's actually, why do we keep saying belief structure? And I think you're putting your finger on it right now. It's because the structure of reality is made of beliefs.
Yes.
Without beliefs, there is no structure.
Yeah.
It's just formless.
Yeah.
As you said.
Yeah.
But it's also, I think, the way we, and maybe there's other ways to do it, and maybe there's even other ways that humans could do it. Maybe this is a societal construct or a cultural or civilizational phenomenon. The particular way that we create beliefs seem to be in the form of statements of expectation. And then it would make sense why our reality matches what we continue to communicate to it, which is, I expect this. Oh, here you go. I expect this. All right.
Totally. So like, let's say... Yeah, I mean, I think like that's right. I think that's what it is. Like you have a story, let's say a belief and a story are kind of interlinked in some sense. You know, often there's a story that you hold that is effectively the basis for a belief structure, or at least like the way you interact with the belief structure is like, I'm a terrible entrepreneur or whatever, right? Let's just say that was the belief structure. Then you're making a prediction about every time that you're going to go down an entrepreneurial route.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I've never noticed that before.
Yeah.
Just now.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
And like, I think it depends on how fervently you believe it.
Uh-huh.
Like, so like, and then that would affect the probability of the, you know, in Thomas Campbell's framework, at least, right? It's like, you may have hope that you're not a terrible entrepreneur, but you have like the experience of being a terrible entrepreneur. Maybe that's a little loosely formed. So you might still have good experiences, even though you believe you're a terrible entrepreneur. And then there's people who are like, no matter what I do, I just always fail, blah, blah, blah. Like I'm just a loser, blah, blah, blah. And so then they just continue to experience that. And then likewise, there's some people who say, I shit great businesses. Like they're just like, they can just do whatever they want. And it's just amazing. And I think that there's people with that belief structure and they do it. Like Elon Musk is like one of those people who can just create because his filter of reality for him says that he can.
Mm-hmm.
And that is literally the reality that he then experiences. Period.
Mm-hmm. So I think the other thing that beliefs maybe are useful for is, well, they're essentially our survival programming. They're the rules that we think the world, the universe, reality operates by this set of rules. And that if we conform to these rules, we'll survive.
Yes, I do think that that's like the way that we are able to conceive of it right now. It's possible that that could evolve over time. Like our narrow ways that we're thinking about it now, maybe reality is something that, like we're putting a construct on reality. Maybe reality is so undefinable that we are creating a belief structure about how reality works in order for us to interact with that belief, with reality. So it is possible that as enough knowledge and time goes by, reality is even more formless, and then we could create new belief structures about how reality works.
Totally.
So I'm not to get too out there about it.
No. I think
so.
I see where you're going, and yeah. I'm going kind of the
you are. I just wanted to like make a note of that. Like, so you're saying it's a survival mechanism under our current rubric. It's a survival mechanism. Like it's possible that we can't actually conceive of what reality is.
I'm even thinking of not even in our current rubric per se. I'm like going back in time, mm-hmm. evolutionarily speaking.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of it as a human, as an animal.
Yeah.
like that is the purpose or that is the function of the belief system or the belief structure from an evolutionary sense is it's literally our software programming that allows us to operate in this hardware world.
Right.
And if you compare humans, like you were talking about before, with, you know, other animals of various levels of consciousness, self-awareness, going through their own states of evolution. But if you think of like a human animal as at least being, if not unique, then highly unusual in a certain particular way, one of those ways is that we come into the world, you know, we're born into the world as a very peculiar kind of creature.
Mm-hmm.
This giant head, giant brain, very formless in terms of like the instinctual hardwired programming that we come into the world with. We're more of an empty vessel, not a completely empty vessel, obviously, but we're very much an empty vessel waiting to be programmed by the environment, by our caretakers, which is one of the things that makes us so universally adaptable. But it's very different than another type of creature, like perhaps a horse or a deer, that is born and within a matter of minutes is up walking around feeding itself. It didn't have to acquire so much of its belief system through learning, through environmental learning, or at least its survival system. Through that environmental software-based learning process, it comes pre-programmed.
How do you know that it comes pre-programmed? What do you mean? Like when you say the distinction between a horse's pre-programming versus our pre-programming, how do you mean that?
I'm just looking at it from what can be observed in the...
Like variability?
More like the default functionality.
Yeah.
I'm saying like humans come into the world, they can't walk, crawl, talk, eat. Well, I guess they can suckle.
But like if nobody taught you how to walk, do you think you would not learn how to walk?
Right. I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that if a human is not...
What's the heritage of your reason? Actually, I'm curious. Sorry, keep going. I interrupted you. I just wanted to make sure I understood the point. Because the thing that's coming up for me is that maybe a horse, for example, is not able to be as malleable with regard to the neuroplasticity.
That's the point I'm making.
Yeah, or the malleable with regard to its belief structure.
I'm saying
whether that comes in or whether they're born with it, whatever happens. Their beliefs are more rigidly adhered to, probably.
Can't really get in the mind of a horse.
Yeah, exactly.
Necessarily.
Exactly.
But by observation, what it looks like to me, and I think maybe other people have drawn this conclusion as well, is that at a minimum, I'm not going to make a comment on like how expansive or extensible the belief system of a horse or a deer or any other animal could be. But it looks like a horse or a deer or many other animals do come like an operating system with many apps pre-installed. Whereas we come more like a computer with a blank hard drive, all practically.
Yeah, I think that might be just like, I don't know, gestation period might be the right word. Like that human babies are born at an earlier stage in the life cycle. That's why we can't walk, for example, whereas a horse can walk the first day it's born, is because they're more fully formed and developed in utero.
But why should that be, I guess, is my point.
I don't know, it just is, I guess.
What I'm suggesting is that the human creature, through evolution, has been calibrated.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
To be
more malleable.
Right.
Yes. Like we're actually...
Which is a trade.
Which is like, yeah, like is happens to be a certain... that makes... And I understand what you're saying. Like for whatever reason, humans are born less defined.
Right.
And therefore...
More open-minded.
Yeah, more just naturally, like inherently... open-minded, I guess.
Which is a trade-off.
Yeah, we actually form more of our structure post-birth, I guess you could say.
And continuously throughout life.
Yeah.
That's what I'm kind of trying to showcase.
That makes sense, actually. That makes a ton of sense. Because if you, right, so if you are let's say a horse or whatever other animals, like a lot of the stuff that you're getting, you're experiencing much more of reality in pre-birth. And so it's just much more static in there, you know, you're having a much more limited kind of experience, and therefore your structure actually is more limited. Your belief structure has to be more limited.
Or at the very least, maybe you could say limited, or you could also say stable.
Yes.
Or you could say...
limited is you're right.
There's a way of saying it less adaptable.
Yeah, less adaptable.
But again, there's trade-offs which is a lot of the survival relevant belief system of a horse, for example, doesn't require a thought process. In the same way that it does for humans.
For sure.
So get up, run away, move away from danger, you know, seek food, like whatever.
I mean, until they come up with a reason to not want to feel that way, right? Like not want to do that. And that comes with the evolution of their knowledge or whatever, probably.
That's fair. That's fair. And again, I'm trying to get in the mind of a horse.
No, I'm saying I think, for example, there might've been a point when humans were like that.
Yeah.
And then... our intelligence created more desire to do more. And so then that required adaptation in our belief structures.
Okay. Well, one way or another, what seems to have happened is that the human creature has developed or has evolved in the direction of being way heavily rotated in the direction of adaptability, malleability.
Yeah.
And so forth, which comes at a cost. There are several, but one of those costs is that human beings are born completely helpless, unlike a horse or a deer or many other creatures. They're born completely helpless and have to be cared for several years before they can even feed themselves or take care of themselves. And even then, it's probably going to be, say, 12 to 16 years of maturity before they're really like functioning on their own.
Yeah.
The flip side of that is the human beings are maybe the only creature on this planet that can live on all seven continents in all different environments. And I think that's what that trade-off is for. I think human beings, and a lot of what I'm saying now comes from having been listening to Brett Weinstein and Heather Hying's podcast for the last few years. I'm like really soaking up a lot of kind of evolutionary biology from them, which has been really interesting to me. But I think the point of that is the human creature comes out ready to be programmed by the environment that it finds itself
in.
Yeah,
that makes sense to me.
So it doesn't come out having default expectations.
Yeah.
Instead, it's like, okay, what am I expecting here? Yeah. What am I getting here? Is this environment hot, cold? Is it toxic? What are we doing?
Yeah.
And it takes several years, actually probably, you know, a decade plus, to basically write that operating system, you know, on a case-by-case basis for each individual. And then collectively, that operating system gets downloaded, institutionalized into the culture.
Yeah.
That carries it from generation to generation.
The thing that you're making me think about a little bit here that's kind of interesting, but I'm not sure. It could be a thread that doesn't make any sense. But the thing that you're making me wonder about is I wonder if the degree to which you are worried about your survivability limits your degree of malleability. So like, you know, you were saying like 12 to 16 years before you're a fully formed human, and they're kids when they were like 10 years old back then that like were married and like, you know, were on the farm doing them whatever, because they were just forced into that position a little bit more to grow up faster. And maybe if you're in that place of survivability, you don't have the time or wherewithal to make your belief structures more malleable. Mm. Like it's the equivalent of the horse being in utero for longer. It's like you have certain things that are going to be happen. You're naturally going to be more narrow. And so as our society has become more developed and we are less worried about survivability, it creates the environment for more flexibility in our belief structures because we have the luxury of doing so.
Exactly. I was going to use that word luxury.
Yeah. But then I'm thinking about the book that you were telling me about the cycles. What's that name of the book with the very complicated title?
Are you talking about The Origin of Consciousness?
Yes.
In the breakdown of the bicameral mind?
Yes. So I haven't read the book, but the way you described it to me is that basically the author looked at the historical record and basically recognized that there were people in higher states of consciousness in prior eras of humanity, let's say.
Not exactly, but a dramatically different state of consciousness.
I see.
Yeah. Wouldn't necessarily have like described it as higher, lower, better.
Yeah, okay.
But different, very different.
Okay, fair enough. I was thinking that let's say that they were able to interact with these broader things that maybe we've lost touch with. And I wonder if that is in contrast though to the survivability thing that I'm talking about or not. Because were they in survival mode, then maybe we have this thought belief structure that maybe the further back you go, the more that people struggle for survivability. Maybe that's just not true.
Yeah, I think that's a belief system, right? Yeah, my thought on that is life conditions change.
Yeah.
So survival strategies update to match life conditions.
Yeah.
I also agree with you that I think that having the freedom to pursue self-directed malleability of one's belief system is a luxury experience as we understand it from what we think our history and our evolution looks like. And maybe there's a lot that we don't know from what things were like long ago in the past. Maybe people had a much different experience and had a lot more luxury than we have right now.
I mean, it's interesting, like, I was thinking about I obviously have thought about magic and different ways of thinking about these ideas. I can do that because I'm not worried about feeding my family.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you were in a period of time where that was your worry, then you're just naturally going to be less malleable because you don't have enough time to even approach it. Like you're living in your structure, and malleability of structure, it just takes time, I think, to some degree, or it takes some contemplation or some time to be aware of it, be with this idea, and then explore it, right?
Yeah. And I would say, I think there's certain life conditions or circumstances that are either supportive or not supportive of the luxury of malleability. And I think that actually can exist on two different extremes.
Yeah.
On the one hand, I think we all know and probably can even, identify times when this has been true for us, that when survival seems threatened, a lot of times the belief system locks down, clamps down, right? Like, okay, now's not really the time for exploration. Now's the time for, food goes in here and I get money from there, and whatever those core beliefs are that we think—
That serve us.
That we think serve us, exactly.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, also, I think there can be life circumstances that we would define as a crisis situation or a breakdown or a breakthrough or different things that are equally, like, let's say, threatening and might feel unstable, but that force us into malleability or that force us to disregard some of our rigid belief systems for the sake of survival, because these are not working here. And it's like, hey, update operating system or, computer shutdown imminent kind of thing.
Totally.
But the point I was trying to make before when, just kind of going through the quick analogy with comparing humans to other animals was just sort of identifying what beliefs are and what they're for. And if we say that, like, okay, so one thing that beliefs are is they're kind of the rules of reality as we understand them that tell us how to interact with the world.
Yeah.
And we come with, for whatever reason, we come with a very open-ended software development kit that can create all different kinds of operating systems.
Yeah.
And that then gives us this kind of capability where we now have this luxury and this capability to even self-reflect and inquire and then intentionally create or recreate our belief system and therefore our experience of reality. And so I guess I think that's interesting to know what it is that we're doing. Like, what is this house that we're living in, and what do these walls represent? And then from that place of like maybe a little bit broader context of knowing what it is that we're doing when we say we want to dissolve a limiting belief, or when we say we want to create an empowering belief or something along those lines, then we can make more intelligent choices, I guess, about that. And then there's this another metaphor I want to drop in, which is, have you heard about the idea or the theory of the technological singularity?
That you can download your mind into a computer, that idea?
Sort of. That's kind of where it seems like the idea tends to always lead to that conclusion.
Yeah, I don't actually know.
But the basic, as I understand it, the basic concept of the quote-unquote singularity is the point at which machine intelligence or artificial, so-called artificial intelligence, becomes iterative to the point that it begins to be able to recreate itself without human operators.
Okay.
And that because machine, you know, computer electrical technology can process information so many orders of magnitude faster than organic computation, that essentially at the point where the computer starts to be able to rewrite its own code, it iterates in a runaway feedback loop.
And totally.
Within
Right?
Yeah. Within a matter of minutes, hours, days, whatever it is.
Yeah. That's right. That's like where we're going to, right? We're going right now to these, from LLMs to AGI, artificial general intelligence, to artificial superintelligence, right? Mm-hmm. And that in theory should happen incredibly quickly based on exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. And that's why they call it a singularity, I think, is because it's kind of like the analogy to the collapsing of a black hole.
Yeah.
Where, you know, okay, the matter falls in and falls in and falls in to a certain point, but once it reaches a critical mass, then it just collapses, boom, and it's gone. It's, you know, it becomes a point, a singularity. In this case, that's more like
What's the black hole element is like, oh, it just, it becomes like self-fulfilling, self-replicating so quickly that it's like,
like nothing can stop it. That's how I understand the analogy to a black hole, is it's just, there's a point in time where the process could conceivably be reversed, but once it passes a certain threshold, it just poof, and you've got a black hole, and there's no process in the universe that can reverse that from that point forward. I think the same idea is when the artificial general intelligence reaches a certain threshold of being able to rewrite its own programming code with a sufficient level of self-awareness, or you may call it intelligence or something like that, that it becomes a runaway process that can no longer be stopped, and you have something new, what you might call artificial superintelligence, which I don't think any of us can really even know what that means or what that even is, but now you've got it, and that's the singularity. That's the moment of singularity. So I think that's what we're actually doing with our own minds. I think we've been doing it for a while. This is the process that I call intentional evolution.
Okay.
Which is that we've crossed some kind of a threshold already at some point, or maybe we're on that threshold now. Maybe we're crossing it. But the point is at which we become self-aware of our own belief system and realize that, oh, we are made of software.
Right.
Literally.
Right.
And we develop the psychological, spiritual technology to rewrite our own code.
Yeah, interesting.
Which then becomes an iterative process of, oh, we're now, it's not to say that we're completely unhooked from this idea of biological evolution, but we're actually iterating something that's orders of magnitude faster than that.
I mean, dude, take that into its limit. I mean, maybe the nature of biological evolution actually become untethered from it. And that may actually be kind of the point, you know? We you know, like, we always have this question of like aliens, like, why don't we see any? Maybe because they've all evolved to this point where they just realize that this is all just a construct.
Right. Talk about a limiting belief.
Yeah, totally.
This whole physical.
You know, because if you think about it, right? Like, I mean, we were talking about like magic before we got, you know, on this recording. If you think about, like, let's say somebody making an object float. Now, mm-hmm. I've never personally seen it, but in theory, gravity, they're manipulating the bounds of what we conceive of as gravity. And that's like mm-hmm. what you would think of as in this 3D reality, mm-hmm. that maybe that's just a construct of our mind that we eventually evolve past.
Mm-hmm.
That's just like, this is like a training ground for that eventual realization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I love the idea of us being in our own singularity. That is such a fascinating idea. I love it. What'd you call that?
I call it intentional evolution.
Intentional evolution. I love that. Yeah, that's
great. Because it essentially means that we've become aware of the system.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And now we're directing it.
I believe that is what you just described is the track that we are on.
Mm-hmm.
Like we are about to evolve very rapidly. And actually, we're talking about artificial intelligence and all this kind of stuff. And actually, that may actually not be a worry in the long run once we can intentionally get to this place where we construct any structure that we want.
Suppose it's happening in parallel.
Yeah.
Suppose there's a machine intelligence, which also achieves intentional evolution.
Yeah.
We call that the singularity, but yeah. Suppose we also are doing the same thing.
Maybe we couldn't even conceive of it until we were in the place that we were doing it ourselves. Who knows?
That makes
they're all like, you know, in some sense, constructs, right? And so until we understand that it can be done, maybe we'd
agree
with the fact that it can be done.
Right. So what do you believe about magic? That you were, this whole conversation started kind of from that point. You were saying that something about magic isn't supernatural. It's just...
it's natural.
It's just that there's more to reality than what our belief systems will allow us to experience. But when we either intentionally begin to expand our belief system, or whether we start to experience a softening or a breakdown because life circumstances are changing, we start to have to question what we believe or whatever, then we start to be able to experience more that seems to be outside of the rule sets that we were taught or at least believed at one time. Doesn't really mean that anything's breaking any rules of reality. It just means this is more of reality that's available to us now.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
I mean, the way you described intentional evolution is sort of how I think about magic, in the sense that these belief structures that we have constructed, we bring attention to that, and then we intentionally make that malleable. And then the degree to which we can make that malleable is much more vast than we thought. And in fact, reality is much more formless. And then we can bring it into form through our conscious, intentional creation. And I think we are on the cusp of, and we call it magic because some people understand it and some people don't yet, but we'll eventually get to the place where this is just how reality works.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Like our understanding of how reality works, and probably keep going from there.
Mm.
You know, it's just the malleability, intentional malleability. And then like, okay, at first it's like, I can build this business and versus not building this business. Okay. That's like the starter pack, if you really think about this. Like, take this again to its limit. You, maybe gravity is malleable. Maybe form is malleable. Who knows? If what we're talking about is really true, in theory, that could be the limit. Is like that it's just, there is no limit.
Mm-hmm.
And that could, from our vantage point now, be conceived of as magical.
Mm-hmm.
When in actuality, that is just how to engage with reality. Once you're really skilled at it, then you really understand how reality works.
What kind of things are you talking about? Are you talking about like kind of physical manipulation?
Totally.
Of the environment through mentalism?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you read about yogis, like yogis would like appear, they would float. You know, there's all kinds of stories about that. You know, there's a lot of things that in the world that thousands of years ago that we still have no explanation for that we barely do now. How did they do that? You know, how did they do that stuff? Maybe they tapped into this thing that we've since lost.
Have you been experiencing some of those things in your own life?
Not like that, but we'll see.
Mm.
I've definitely experienced like things that I'm sure other people have experienced in spiritual circles and things like this, where their minds become more open, like synchronicities and other experiences, or kind of like intuition that's really heightened, that's like spot on. I've experienced things that feel magical, but like I think it's like I'll speak for myself, the form of the belief structure around our 3D reality is incredibly rigid. We're born, we have pain, we have all these different physical experiences. The bounds of that are incredibly rigid, I think, for most of us. I think that there are some people that have lived that maybe that wasn't the case quite as much for them, but like, I think for the vast majority of us, that is more rigid. And so to get through that takes work, I think, like softening those belief structures over time. And maybe there's people who do it very quickly, but I think it takes a lot of like intentional work and time and practice to soften the bounds of reality as we experience it in this sort of like what we conceive of as a 3D reality, where you're sitting on that chair, I'm sitting on this chair, we're feeling gravity, we're in this place. And I think like, can we transcend that? I don't know. It's right now, it's, I believe that we can, but obviously my belief is not strong enough yet, because otherwise I would do it. If I was to really diagnose my belief, I believe that I'll eventually get there in some form or fashion, or and I believe that I'm on the road to understanding at least this better. And the degree to which that happens isn't instant, but it's like, and that's maybe just a construct of my mind, because that's the idea that it could become instant is something that like my current belief structure won't allow me to believe. That's kind of how I think about it.
What part of your belief system or your belief structure right now would you say is one of the most rigid parts that you might even imagine could be limiting your potential of reality?
Just say the question again.
What's a wall in your house that you notice you can't see around? If there's things that you think are available to be experienced, but you're not experiencing them like magic, what's a rigid wall in your belief structure that you think might be holding you back?
That's an interesting question. I think like I'm still like, I dabble in starter pack mode. Do you know what I mean? Like in the, like I'm still trying to make malleable this 3D reality, meaning like accomplish some things like relationship wise or professionally or physically or whatever, right? And that's like starter pack mode to me.
Yeah.
But I am also dabbling with these other things. It kind of feels like you have to go through starter pack mode almost because it's like, it's still to manipulate like your, manipulate, to like create a reality that's still based in this 3D reality. Like, so like you're still in the house, but I'm just taking down a wall in my house, as opposed to being in a house and then suddenly the house disappears and you create a, like a new house that you live in. Like that's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not there yet. I'm still in the starter pack mode of like, I am in this body. I live in Austin. I do this work. I do, you know, I work in finance and I am doing this every day and like, and can I, knowing what I know now about belief structures, which I am fully immersed in that thought process, can I just create the reality within those confines first? And then once I see that changing, it like, it will then, by definition, if I see that happening, it actually makes the bounds of the house more flexible, because I'm starting to believe more that the whole structure is flexible. So I think it's like steps. You have to like take it one step at a time. Does that make sense?
Because
you're going through layers of your belief.
Yeah, I got you.
You know?
And you build up, it's like a muscle.
Yeah.
You build up confidence and you receive validation that like, oh, this can change. This did change. Yeah. I now believe this will change.
Yes.
It's very meta.
Totally.
Changing your own belief system.
Yeah. It's like iterative, just like you were talking about.
Yeah. What's a belief that has changed for you at some point in your life that had a dramatic impact on your experience of reality?
I mean, I've been on like a pretty intense, like I at least had gone through a pretty intense healing journey in my life where I think I was restricted in my belief structures around myself. And then going through that healing structure, I then experienced my life in a completely different way. It feels very like 3D locked, I know, and feels like kind of conventional, but to me it was very profound. And then I experienced my capacity to even be with the idea that we're talking about is a result of me going through this belief transition in myself. Does that make sense?
What was the belief transition? What was the old belief and what's the new belief?
I mean, I think it's just like your typical stuff about like maybe not feeling capable enough or good enough or not trusting yourself or whatever, and then transitioning to a place where I love who I am and I trust myself and I feel capable, et cetera. And then like my world, realizing that my world was changing simply as a result of the shifting in my own belief structures, and then allowing me to tap into different, that, I mean, that also through medicine journeys and just also personal reflection allowed me to tap into my own intuition and being more aware of these other aspects of myself that then allowed me to sort of see, again, like these rigid belief structures where it'll start to become deconstructed, which opened me up to other aspects of this 3D reality. But it's amazing what comes down in these belief structures. So you think that they're rigidly adhered to, like, I'm not good enough or whatever, but actually in there is also stuff that's like metaphysical in nature that's also coming down, like that I wasn't really realizing. Because like once you start, let's say, trusting yourself, loving the way your mind works, whatever, then suddenly the things that you're thinking about have a lot more resonance because you're not doubting yourself quite as much. And then so you're like, this is my experience of it. And so then suddenly the malleability, the things that I'm experiencing, I'm no longer doubting. I'm experiencing this thing. And then that then leads to forming ideas of the nature that we're talking about. And so like it kind of is like, it just keeps going. It's like the walls become fuzzy, and they become fuzzy in all of these ways that, or when walls come down, like there's parts of the structure that you didn't even know were there that are incidentally benefiting, that like you're just like, it's like sort of mind opening. And it's just like malleability begets more malleability, is how I think about it, actually. Mm-hmm. It's just like the nature of it is like it becomes more flexible. Mm-hmm. Like your system, the more you go down the path, the more malleable the system becomes.
But there's something about malleability plus control or plus intention where it's like, it's not just, it's not chaotically malleable, but it's like firm, but flexible, adaptable to different circumstances or situations. Meaning it's like one could imagine.
I don't think it's necessarily, I think it can be chaotically malleable.
Yeah, no, it can be.
You know,
I think that's what we're experiencing now.
Yeah.
Is that exactly. Chaotic malleability.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly.
Where it's like, oh, wait, my belief system, my belief structure is dissolving, is breaking down. I'm losing walls here. And
yeah, what the fuck is going on with reality?
What's going on?
Yeah.
Cartesian crisis, existential crisis, whatever. But then I imagine,
and then it's going in crazy, it's sort of going in what we perceive as like these wild directions because it's not intentional. It's sort of like then people are being triggered in certain ways and they're creating new belief structures that feel like chaotic, I guess.
Right. So when you say malleability begets more malleability, there's a sense, there's one sense in which that could be taken where it feels like a hurricane comes through my belief system and starts blowing down the walls or moving them around, and it just keeps spinning faster and faster and faster and faster, and there's nothing that's stable or certain. But there's another sense of malleability begets malleability, which is what I really think you were trying to communicate, or at least what resonates for me as what I call intentional evolution, which is I start trying to shift or move a wall, or I notice that it's become more flexible or permeable, and that then allows me to start to develop an intentional malleability with conscious manipulation, meaning, oh, well, what if I put this here? Oh, well, what if I put this there? And then the control becomes more easeful and fluid, but it doesn't mean that the structure becomes softer and softer and softer until it goes away altogether. It becomes more of an ongoing process of transformation with agency.
Yeah, totally. It's exactly right.
That's what I think is happening. And I wonder what that's like when enough of us reach that point. So we imagine that on an individual level.
Yeah.
And then there's the collective interactions among those beliefs.
Well, that's what we were talking about. Like, it's funny you triggered that thought when you were talking about, like, when we started talking about, like, if we had a wall between my kitchen and my living room, and we're like, let's take down that wall because that makes sense. And then we're like, but I don't want to take down the wall between my apartment and the hallway, or between my living room and my bathroom, or my living room and my bedroom. But I think that that's like based in some sense on a narrowly defined construct that we've created based on prior belief structures.
That's where the cultural belief system and the and our individual belief system overlap.
Exactly. Like they formed how we are, right? But like, dude, think about this. Like they're like thousands of years ago, there were people where the entire society was dedicated to building one pyramid or whatever. You know, like we can't even conceive of that right now. But like, I think if we start to like intentionally create this thing, like I said, it's going to be a rough entry. But the just like the singularity you were talking about, the human singularity is going to go vertical in terms of us just like going into this creation mode. And so then like the bounds of our reality are so malleable at that point. What would you do? Because like the conventional stuff that we stick to seems pretty pedestrian at that point. Like, do we care about money? Do we care about this? Do we care about that? Maybe not. Because like all of it's available to us because it's based on what we create. So then all the stuff that we conventionally worry about goes out the window because we have all the abundance we want. We have all the resources we want. We have all the spiritual kind of systems we want. So then what would you create? I think it's like basically the most magnificent forms of art you could possibly imagine just for the sake of doing it, because that's what you would engage with, because there's nothing. I think it would be like, what is the coolest thing you could possibly imagine and create that? And just making sure other people can experience that, it feels like.
You know, going down that line of thinking, really, it really opens something up, which is when you say, what's the coolest thing you can imagine? We can only even imagine cool. What kind of thing would that even be? We can only imagine that from within our current belief system.
Exactly. This is my
point. So like when we reach that point, whatever we think is cool is going to be completely different.
This is why I'm saying, this is why I was saying before about how even in the construct of survivability, et cetera, the construct of how we're even thinking about reality right now may evolve.
Well, and that's exactly the thesis of Julian Jayne's Origin of Consciousness book. That's exactly the thesis.
Yeah.
The thesis is, you know, 12,000 years ago, the human species was experiencing a completely different kind of reality than what we experience now.
Yeah.
They were like aliens,
right,
would be to us today.
Right.
And that can happen again. And that is actually exactly what I think is happening.
That's what I think is happening as well.
I think that however long, 100, 1,000 years from now, whatever it may look like, humanity as a species will have a different kind of consciousness, in a different, like a different consciousness in kind from what we're experiencing now. And so whatever those people think is cool would be very interesting to see.
Totally.
Because whatever we think is cool now is something like a pyramid, but just made out of glass and chrome and the shiny LEDs on it or something, which is still pretty, what was the word you used? Pedestrian.
Yeah, exactly. Like we really can't conceive of it yet, I feel like, you know?
Exactly.
And like, this is actually like why I don't worry about the future, really. You know, I think a lot of people are worried about the future. I don't worry about the future for exactly this reason, actually. And in fact, I've trained my mind not to worry. Like, that doesn't mean that like I'm not on top of the things that need like my handling of things. But like, to hold a worry is to imagine and create a story around a future event that you currently don't know. So you're actually creating a belief structure around something. That's like, and then you're holding on to that worry. And so one, I don't do that anymore because I'm vanquishing myself of these like belief structures that don't serve me intentionally. So like just holding things that I'm assuming negative outcomes or stories that I'm creating around that. Again, that's not meaning I'm not taking care of the things that I need to take care of. to make sure that my family's safe or whatever. But like to hold on to this thing is actually like you are creating, by holding on to worry, you are creating a belief structure where that outcome is like embedded in your reality construct and the way you'll feel about reality and what will happen. And so when I've done that, like suddenly these like beautiful awarenesses about reality are coming about once I start releasing these aspects. Like suddenly like the things that, yeah, like there's things that like pop up, but I actually like, I feel really optimistic about the future.
That feels like a perfect place to bring it to a close.
Yeah.
I also feel optimistic about the future.
Yeah. Awesome.
I feel optimistic about our ability to self-reflect on our own belief systems in ever more interesting and intelligent and creative ways.
I agree with that as well.
Thank you for this conversation, Vic. This was super fun.
Yeah, it was awesome. Thanks, Vishen.
Thanks for joining me for this sacred conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And don't forget that the conversation can always continue. We can build on a topic that we've already talked about, and we can also start new topics and see how they all weave together. And that's just the exciting thing about this whole journey of exploration, is we don't know where it's going to go, but I'm really excited to find out with you. Please don't be shy to reach out and schedule your sacred conversation on whatever topic is interesting to you. Thanks a lot, and I look forward to talking with you soon.